ever. You don't understand, she said, now dabbing at eyes wet with mirth. He thought she was awful. He would have told me. Owen talked about everyone he'd slept with. He wasn't a gentleman like that, was he, Pip? I'd have known if they'd ever... I don't know where Michael Fancourt got that from. Never, said Catherine Kent, with unforced merriment and total conviction. The laughter had loosened her up.
But you don't know what the cutter really meant, Robin asked her, setting her empty brandy glass down on the pine coffee table with the finality of a guest about to take their leave.
I never said I didn't know, said Catherine, still out of breath from her protracted laughter. I do know. It was just awful to do it to Jerry. Such a bloody hypocrite. Owen tells me not to mention it to anyone, and then he goes and puts it in Bombix Mori.
Robin did not need Strike's look to tell her to remain silent and let Catherine's brandy-fueled good humour, her enjoyment of their undivided attention, and the reflected glory of knowing sensitive secrets about literary figures do their work.
All right, she said. All right, here it is. Owen told me as we were leaving. Jerry was very drunk that night, and you know his marriage is on the rocks, has been for years. He and Fenella had had a really terrible row the night before the party, and she told him that their daughter might not be his. That she might be...
Strike knew what was coming.
Fancourt's,
said Catherine, after a suitable dramatic pause. The dwarf with the big head. The baby she thought of aborting because she didn't know whose it was. Do you see? The cutter with his cuckold's horns. And Owen told me to keep my mouth shut. It's not funny, he said. Jerry loves his daughter. Only good thing he's got in his life. But he talked about it all the way home. On and on about Fancourt and how much he'd hate finding out he had a daughter because Fancourt never wanted kids. All that bullshit about protecting Jerry. Anything to get at Michael Fancourt. Anything.
Chapter 46. Leander strived. The waves about him wound and pulled him to the bottom where the ground was strewed with pearl. Christopher Marlowe, Hero and Leander. Grateful for the effect of cheap brandy, and to Robin's particular combination of clear-headedness and warmth, Strike parted from her with many thanks half an hour later. Robin travelled home to Matthew in a glow of gratification and excitement, looking more kindly on Strike's theory as to the killer of Owen Quine than she had done before. This was partly because nothing that Catherine Kent had said had contradicted it, but mainly because she felt particularly warm towards her boss after the shared interrogation. Strike returned to his attic rooms in a less elevated frame of mind. He had drunk nothing but tea and believed more strongly than ever in his theory, but all the proof he could offer was a single typewriter cassette. It would not be enough to overturn the police case against Leonora. There were hard frosts overnight on Saturday and Sunday, but during the daytime glimmers of sunshine pierced the cloud blanket. Rain turned some of the accumulated snow in the gutters to sliding slush. Strike brooded alone between his rooms and his office, ignoring a call from Nina Lascelles and turning down an invitation to dinner at Nick and Ilse's, pleading paperwork, but actually preferring solitude without pressure to discuss the Quine case. He knew that he was acting as though he were held to a professional standard that had ceased to apply when he had left the Special Investigation Branch. Though legally free to gossip to whomever he pleased about his suspicions, he continued to treat them as confidential. This was partly long-standing habit, but mainly because, much as others might jeer, he took extremely seriously the possibility that the killer might hear what he was thinking and doing. In Strike's opinion, the safest way of ensuring that secret information did not leak was not to tell anybody about it. On Monday, he was visited again by the boss and boyfriend of the faithless Miss Brocklehurst, whose masochism now extended to a wish to know whether she had, as he strongly suspected, a third lover hidden away somewhere. Strike listened, with half his mind on the activities of Dave Polworth, who was starting to feel like his last hope. Robin's endeavours remained fruitless, in spite of the hours she was spending pursuing the evidence he had asked her to find. At 6:30 that evening, as he sat in his flat watching the forecast, which predicted a return of Arctic weather by the end of the week, his phone rang.
"Guess what, did he?"
said Polworth down a crackling line.
"You're kidding me,"
said Strike, his chest suddenly tight with anticipation.
"Got the lot, mate." "Holy shit," breathed Strike.
It had been his own theory, but he felt as astonished as if Polworth had done it all unaided.
"Bagged up here, waiting for you. I'll send someone for it first thing tomorrow, and I'm going to go home and have a nice hot bath," said Polworth. "Chum, you're a bloody—" "I know I am. We'll talk about my credit later. I'm fucking freezing, Daddy. I'm going home."
Strike called Robin with the news. Her elation matched his own.
"Right, tomorrow," she said, full of determination. "Tomorrow I'm going to get it. I'm going to make sure—"
"Don't go getting careless," Strike talked over her. "It's not a competition."
He barely slept that night. Robin made no appearance at the office until 1 p.m, but the instant he heard the glass door bang and heard her calling him, he knew.
"You haven't—"
"Yes," she said breathlessly.
She thought he was going to hug her, which would be crossing a line he had never even approached before, but the lunge she had thought might be meant for her was really for the mobile on his desk.
"I'm calling Anstis. We've done it, Robin."
"Cormoran, I think—"
Robin started to say, but he did not hear her. He had hurried back into his office and closed the door behind him. Robin lowered herself into her computer chair, feeling uneasy. Strike's muffled voice rose and fell beyond the door. She got up restlessly to visit the bathroom, where she washed her hands and stared into the cracked and spotted mirror over the sink, observing the inconveniently bright gold of her hair. Returning to the office, she sat down, could not settle to anything, noticed that she had not switched on her tiny tinsel Christmas tree, did so, and waited, absent-mindedly biting her thumbnail, something she had not done for years. 20 minutes later, his jaw set and his expression ugly, Strike emerged from the office.
"Stupid fucking dickhead,"
were his first words.
"No,"
gasped Robin.
"He's having none of it,"
said Strike, too wound up to sit, but limping up and down the enclosed space.
"He's had that bloody rag in the lock-up and analysed it, and he's got Quine's blood on it. Big effin' deal. Could have cut himself months ago. He's so in love with his own effin' theory."
"Did you say to him, if he just gets a warrant—"
"Dickhead!"
roared Strike, punching the metal filing cabinet so that it reverberated and Robin jumped.
"But he can't deny. Once forensics are done—"
"That's the bleeding point, Robin,"
he said, rounding on her.
"Unless he searches before he gets forensics done, there might be nothing there to find."
"But did you tell him about the typewriter?"
"If the simple fact that it's there doesn't hit the prick between the eyes."
She ventured no more suggestions but watched him walk up and down, brow furrowed, too intimidated to tell him now what was worrying her.
"Fuck it," growled Strike on his sixth walk back to her desk. "Shock and awe. No choice."
"Al?"
he muttered, pulling out his mobile again.
"And Nick."
"Who's Nick?"
asked Robin, desperately trying to keep up.
He's married to Leonora's lawyer, said Strike, punching buttons on his phone. Old mate, he's a gastroenterologist.
He retreated again to his office and slammed the door. For want of anything else to do, Robin filled the kettle, her heart hammering, and made them both tea. The mugs cooled untouched while she waited. When Strike emerged 15 minutes later, he seemed calmer.
All right, he said, seizing his tea and taking a gulp. I've got a plan and I'm gonna need you. Are you up for it?
Of course, said Robin.
He gave her a concise outline of what he wanted to do. It was ambitious and would require a healthy dose of luck.
Well? Strike asked her finally.
No problem, said Robin.
We might not need you.
No, said Robin.
On the other hand, you could be key.
Yes, said Robin.
Sure that's all right?
Strike asked, watching her closely.
No problem at all, said Robin. I want to do it, I really do. It's just...
She hesitated.
I think he...
What?
Said Strike sharply.
I think I'd better have a practice,
said Robin.
Oh, said Strike, eyeing her. Yeah, fair enough. Got until Thursday, I think. I'll check the date now.
He disappeared for the third time into his inner office. Robin returned to her computer chair. She desperately wanted to play her part in the capture of Owen Quine's killer, but what she had been about to say before Strike's sharp response panicked her out of it was,
I think he might have seen me.
Chapter 47
Thou entanglest thyself in thine own work like a silkworm.
John Webster, The White Devil.
By the light of the old-fashioned street lamp, the cartoonish murals covering the front of the Chelsea Arts Club were strangely eerie. Circus freaks had been painted on the rainbow-stippled walls of a long, low line of ordinary white houses knocked into one. A four-legged blonde girl, an elephant eating its keeper, an etiolated contortionist in prison stripes, whose head appeared to be disappearing up his own anus. The club stood in a leafy, sleepy, and genteel street, quiet with the snow that had returned with a vengeance, falling fast and mounting over roofs and pavements as though the brief respite in the Arctic winter had never been. All through Thursday, the blizzard had grown thicker, and now, viewed through a rippling lamplit curtain of icy flakes, the old club in its fresh pastel colours appeared strangely insubstantial, pasteboard scenery, a trompe-l'oeil marquee. Strike was standing in a shadowy alley off Old Church Street, watching as one by one they arrived for their small party. He saw the aged Pinkelman helped from his taxi by a stone-faced Jerry Waldegrave, while Daniel Chard stood in a fur hat on his crutches, nodding and smiling an awkward welcome. Elizabeth Tassel drew up alone in a cab, fumbling for her fare and shivering in the cold. Lastly, in a car with a driver, came Michael Fancourt. He took his time getting out of the car, straightening his coat before proceeding up the steps to the front door. The detective, on whose dense curly hair the snow was falling thickly, pulled out his mobile and rang his half-brother.
"Hey," said Al, who sounded excited. "They're all in the dining room." "How many?"
"About a dozen of them."
"Coming in now."
Strike limped across the street with the aid of his stick. They let him in at once when he gave his name and explained that he was here as Duncan Gilfedder's guest. Al and Gilfedder, a celebrity photographer whom Strike was meeting for the first time, stood a short way inside the entrance. Gilfedder seemed confused as to who Strike was, or why he, a member of this eccentric and charming club, had been asked by his acquaintance Al to invite a guest whom he did not know.
"My brother," said Al,
introducing them. He sounded proud. "Oh," said Gilfedder blankly. He wore the same type of glasses as Christian Fisher, and his lank hair was cut in a straggly shoulder-length bob.
"I thought your brother was younger."
"That's Eddie," said Al.
"This is Cormoran, ex-army. He's a detective now."
"Oh,"
said Gilfedder, looking even more bemused.
"Thanks for this," Strike said, addressing both men equally. "Get you another drink."
The club was so noisy and packed, it was hard to see much of it, except glimpses of squashy sofas and a crackling log fire. The walls of the low-ceilinged bar were liberally covered in prints, paintings, and photographs. It had the feeling of a country house, cosy and a little scruffy. As the tallest man in the room, Strike could see over the crowd's heads towards the windows at the rear of the club. Beyond lay a large garden lit by exterior lights so that it was illuminated in patches. A thick, pristine layer of snow, pure and smooth as royal icing, lay over verdant shrubbery and the stone sculptures lurking in the undergrowth. Strike reached the bar and ordered wine for his companions, glancing as he did so into the dining room. Those eating filled several long wooden tables. There was the Roper Chard party, with a pair of French windows beside them, the garden icy white and ghostly behind the glass. A dozen people, some of whom Strike did not recognize, had gathered to honor the 90-year-old Pinkelman, who was sitting at the head of the table. Whoever had been in charge of the placement, Strike saw, had sat Elizabeth Tassel and Michael Fancourt well apart. Fancourt was talking loudly into Pinkelman's ear, Chard opposite him. Elizabeth Tassel was sitting next to Jerry Waldegrave. Neither was speaking to the other. Strike passed glasses of wine to Al and Gilfedder, then returned to the bar to fetch a whiskey for himself, deliberately maintaining a clear view of the Roper Chard party.
"Why," said a voice, clear as a bell but somewhere below him, "are you here?"
Nina Lascelles was standing at his elbow in the same strappy black dress she had worn to his birthday dinner. No trace of her former giggly flirtatiousness remained. She looked accusatory.
"Hi," said Strike, surprised. "I didn't expect to see you here."
"Nor I you," she said.
He had not returned any of her calls for over a week, not since the night he had slept with her to rid himself of thoughts of Charlotte on her wedding day.
"So, you know Pinkelman," said Strike, trying for small talk in the face of what he could tell was animosity.
"I'm taking over some of Jerry's authors now he's leaving. Pink's is one of them."
"Congratulations," said Strike.
Still, she did not smile.
"Waldegrave still came to the party, though."
"Pink's is fond of Jerry."
"Why," she repeated, "are you here?"
"Doing what I was hired to do," said Strike. "Trying to find out who killed Owen Quine."
She rolled her eyes, clearly feeling that he was pushing his persistence past a joke.
"How did you get in here? It's members only."
"I've got a contact," said Strike.
"You didn't think of using me again, then?" she asked.
He did not much like the reflection of himself he saw in her large mouse-like eyes. There was no denying that he had used her repeatedly. It had become cheap, shameful, and she deserved better.
"I thought that might be getting old," said Strike.
"Yeah," said Nina. "You thought right."
She turned from him and walked back to the table, filling the last vacant seat between two employees whom he did not know. Strike was in Jerry Waldegrave's direct line of vision. Waldegrave caught sight of him, and Strike saw the editor's eyes widen behind his horn-rimmed glasses. Alerted by Waldegrave's transfixed stare, Chard twisted in his seat, and he, too, clearly recognized Strike.
"How's it going?"
asked Al excitedly at Strike's elbow.
"Great," said Strike. "Where is that Gil-summing gone?" Downed his drink and left. Doesn't know what the hell we're up to, said Al. Al did not know why they were here either. Strike had told him nothing, except that he needed entry to the Chelsea Arts Club tonight, and that he might need a lift. Al's bright red Alfa Romeo Spider sat parked a little down the road. It had been agony on Strike's knee to get in and out of the low-slung vehicle. As he had intended, half the Roper Chard table now seemed acutely aware of his presence. Strike was positioned so that he could see them reflected clearly in the dark French windows. Two Elizabeth Tassels were glaring at him over their menus. Two Ninas were determinedly ignoring him, and two shiny-pated Chards summoned a waiter each and muttered in their ears.
"Is that the bald bloke we saw in the River Cafe?" asked Al.
"Yeah," said Strike, grinning, as the solid waiter separated from his reflected wraith and made his way towards them.
"I think we're about to be asked whether we've got the right to be here."
"Very sorry, sir," began the waiter in a mutter as he reached Strike. "But could I ask?"
"Al Rogby. My brother and I are here with Duncan Gilfeder," said Al pleasantly, before Strike could respond.
Al's tone expressed surprise that they had been challenged at all. He was a charming and privileged young man who was welcome everywhere, whose credentials were impeccable, and whose casual roping of Strike into the family pen conferred upon him that same sense of easy entitlement. Johnny Ropeby's eyes looked out of Al's narrow face. The waiter muttered hasty apologies and retreated.
"Are you just trying to put the wind up them?" asked Al, staring over at the publisher's table.
"Can't hurt," said Strike with a smile, sipping his whiskey as he watched Daniel Chard deliver what was clearly a stilted speech in Pinkelman's honour. A card and present were brought out from under the table. For every look and smile they gave the old writer, there was a nervous glance towards the large, dark man staring at them from the bar. Michael Fancourt alone had not looked around. Either he remained in ignorance of the detective's presence, or was untroubled by it. When starters had been put in front of them all, Jerry Waldegrave got to his feet and moved out from the table towards the bar. Nina and Elizabeth's eyes followed him. On Waldegrave's way to the bathroom, he merely nodded at Strike, but on the way back, he paused.
"Surprised to see you here."
"Yeah?" said Strike.
"Yeah," said Waldegrave. "You're, making people feel uncomfortable."
"Nothing I can do about that," said Strike.
"You could try not staring us out."
"This is my brother, Al,"
said Strike, ignoring the request. Al beamed and held out a hand, which Waldegrave shook, seeming nonplussed.
"You're annoying Daniel," Waldegrave told Strike, looking directly into the detective's eyes.
"That's a shame," said Strike.
The editor rumpled his untidy hair.
"Well, if that's your attitude."
"Surprised you care how Daniel Chard feels."
"I don't, particularly," said Waldegrave. "But he can make life unpleasant for other people when he's in a bad mood. I'd like tonight to go well for Pinkelman. I can't understand why you're here."
"Wanted to make a delivery," said Strike.
He pulled a blank white envelope out from an inside pocket.
"What is this?"
"It's for you," said Strike.
Waldegrave took it, looking utterly confused.
"Something you should think about," said Strike, moving closer to the bemused editor in the noisy bar. "Fancourt had mumps, you know, before his wife died."
"What?"
said Waldegrave, bewildered.
"Never had kids. Pretty sure he's infertile. Thought you might be interested."
Waldegrave stared at him, opened his mouth, found nothing to say, then walked away, still clutching the white envelope.
"What was that?"
Al asked Strike agog.
Plan A, said Strike. We'll see.
Waldegrave sat back down at the Roper Chard table. Mirrored in the black window beside him, he opened the envelope Strike had given him. Puzzled, he pulled out a second envelope. There was a scribbled name on this one. The editor looked up at Strike, who raised his eyebrows. Jerry Waldegrave hesitated, then turned to Elizabeth Tassel and passed her the envelope. She read what was written on it, frowning. Her eyes flew to Strike's. He smiled and toasted her with his glass. She seemed uncertain as to what to do for a moment. Then she nudged the girl beside her and passed the envelope on. It travelled up the table and across it, into the hands of Michael Fancourt.
There we are, said Strike. Al, I'm going into the garden for a fag. Stay here and keep your phone on.
They don't allow mobile... But Al caught sight of Strike's expression and amended hastily.
Will do.
Chapter 48. Does the silkworm expend her yellow labours for thee? For thee does she undo herself?
Thomas Middleton, The Revenger's Tragedy. The garden was deserted and bitterly cold. Strike sank up to his ankles in snow, unable to feel the cold seeping through his right trouser leg. All the smokers who would ordinarily have congregated on the smooth lawns had chosen the street instead. He ploughed a solitary trench through the frozen whiteness, surrounded by silent beauty, coming to a halt beside a small round pond that had become a disk of thick grey ice. A plump bronze cupid sat in the middle on an oversized clamshell. It wore a wig of snow and pointed its bow and arrow, not anywhere that it might hit a human being, but straight up at the dark heavens. Strike lit a cigarette and turned back to look at the blazing windows of the club. The diners and waiters looked like paper cutouts moving against a lit screen. If Strike knew his man, he would come. Wasn't this an irresistible situation to a writer, to the compulsive spinner of experience into words, to a lover of the macabre and the strange? And sure enough, after a few minutes, Strike heard a door open, a snatch of conversation and music hastily muffled, then the sound of deadened footsteps.
Mr. Strike.
Fancourt's head looked particularly large in the darkness.
Would it not be easier to go onto the street? I'd rather do this in the garden, said Strike. I see.
Fancourt sounded vaguely amused, as though he intended, at least in the short term, to humour Strike. The detective suspected that it appealed to the writer's sense of theatre that he should be the one summoned from the table of anxious people to talk to the man who was making them all so nervous.
What's this about? Asked Fancourt.
Value your opinion, said Strike. Question of critical analysis of Bombyx Mori.
A game? Said Fancourt.
His good humour was cooling with his feet. He pulled his coat more closely around him and said, the snow falling thick and fast,
I've said everything I want to say about that book. One of the first things I was told about Bombyx Mori, said Strike, was that it was reminiscent of your early work. Gore and arcane symbolism, I think, were the words used. So, said Fancourt, hands in his pockets. So, the more I've talked to people who knew Quine, the clearer it's become that the book that everyone's read bears only a vague resemblance to the one he claimed to be writing.
Fancourt's breath rose in a cloud before him, obscuring the little that Strike could see of his heavy features.
I've even met a girl who says she heard part of the book that doesn't appear in the final manuscript.
Writer's cut, said Fancourt, shuffling his feet, his shoulders hunched up around his ears. Owen would have done well to cut a great deal more. Several novels, in fact.
There are also all the duplications from his earlier work, said Strike. Two hermaphrodites, two bloody bags, all that gratuitous sex.
He was a man of limited imagination, Mr. Strike.
He left behind a scribbled note with what looks like a bunch of possible character names on it. One of those names appears on a used typewriter cassette that came out of his study before the police sealed it off. But it's nowhere in the finished manuscript.
So he changed his mind, said Fancourt irritably.
It's an everyday name, not symbolic or archetypal like the names in the finished manuscript, said Strike.
His eyes becoming accustomed to the darkness, Strike saw a look of faint curiosity on Fancourt's heavy-featured face.
A restaurant full of people witnessed what I think is going to turn out to be Quine's last meal and his final public performance, Strike went on. A credible witness says that Quine shouted for the whole restaurant to hear that one of the reasons Tassel was too cowardly to represent the book was Fancourt's limp dick.
He doubted that he and Fancourt were clearly visible to the jittery people at the publisher's table. Their figures would blend with the trees and statuary, but the determined or desperate might still be able to make out their location by the tiny luminous eye of Strike's glowing cigarette, a marksman's bead.
Thing is, there is nothing in Bombix Mori about your dick, continued Strike. There is nothing in there about Quine's mistress and his young transgendered friend being beautiful lost souls, which is how he told them he was going to describe them. And you don't pour acid on silkworms. You boil them to get their cocoons.
So? Repeated Fancourt.
So I've been forced to the conclusion, said Strike, that the Bombix Mori everyone's read is a different book to the Bombix Mori Owen Quine wrote.
Fancourt stopped shuffling his feet. Momentarily frozen, he appeared to give Strike's word serious consideration.
I... No, he said, almost it seemed to himself. Quine wrote that book. It's his style.
It's funny you should say that, because everyone else who had a decent ear for Quine's particular style seems to detect a foreign voice in the book. Daniel Chard thought it was Waldegrave, Waldegrave thought it was Elizabeth Tassel, and Christian Fisher heard you.
Fancourt shrugged with his usual easy arrogance. Quine was trying to imitate a better writer. Don't you think the way he treats his living models is strangely uneven?
Fancourt, accepting the cigarette Strike offered him and a light, now listened in silence and with interest.
He says his wife and agent were parasites on him, Strike said. Unpleasant, but the sort of accusation anyone could throw at the people who might be said to live off his earnings. He implies his mistress isn't fond of animals, and throws in something that could either be a veiled reference to her producing crap books, or a pretty sick allusion to breast cancer. His transgendered friend gets off with a jibe about vocal exercises, and that's after she claims she showed him the life story she was writing and shared all her deepest secrets. He accuses Chard of effectively killing Joe North, and makes a crass suggestion of what Chard really wanted to do to him. And there's the accusation that you were responsible for your first wife's death. All of which is either in the public domain, public gossip, or an easy accusation to sling.
Which isn't to say it wasn't hurtful, said Fancourt quietly.
Agreed, said Strike.
It gave plenty of people reason to be pissed off with him.
But the only real revelation in the book is the insinuation that you fathered Joanna Waldegrave.
I told you, as good as told you, last time we met, said Fancourt, sounding tense, that accusation is not only false, but impossible. I am infertile, as Quine should have known, agreed Strike. Because you and he were still ostensibly on good terms when you had mumps, and he'd already made a jibe about it in the Balzac brothers. And that makes the accusation contained in the cutter even stranger, doesn't it? As though it was written by someone who didn't know that you were infertile. Didn't any of this occur to you when you read the book?
The snow fell thickly on the two men's hair, on their shoulders.
I didn't think Owen cared whether any of it was true or not, said Fancourt slowly, exhaling smoke. Mud sticks. He was just flinging a lot around. I thought he was looking to cause as much trouble as possible. Do you think that's why he sent you an early copy of the manuscript?
When Fancourt did not respond, Strike went on.
It's easily checkable, you know. Courier, postal service, there'll be a record. You might as well tell me.
A lengthy pause.
All right, said Fancourt at last. When did you get it?
The morning of the 6th.
What did you do with it?
Burned it,
said Fancourt shortly, exactly like Catherine Kent.
I could see what he was doing, trying to provoke a public row, maximize publicity. The last resort of a failure. I was not going to humour him.
Another snatch of the interior revelry reached them as the door to the garden opened and closed again. Uncertain footsteps winding through the snow, and then a large shadow looming out of the darkness.
What?
Croaked Elizabeth Tassel, who was wrapped in a heavy coat with a fur collar.
Is going on out here?
The moment he heard her voice, Fancourt made to move back inside. Strike wondered when was the last time they had come face to face in anything less than a crowd of hundreds.
Wait a minute, will you?
Strike asked the writer. Fancourt hesitated. Tassel addressed Strike in her deep, croaky voice.
Pinks is missing, Michael.
Something you'd know all about, said Strike.
The snow whispered down upon the leaves and onto the frozen pond where the Cupid sat, pointing his arrow skywards.
You thought Elizabeth's writing lamentably derivative. Isn't that right?
Strike asked Fancourt.
You both studied Jacobean revenge tragedies, which accounts for the similarities in your styles. But you're a very good imitator of other people's writing, I think,
Strike told Tassel. He had known that she would come if he took Fancourt away, known that she would be frightened of what he was telling the writer out in the dark. She stood perfectly still as snow landed in her fur collar on her iron-grey hair. Strike could just make out the contours of her face by the faint light of the club's distant windows. The intensity and emptiness of her gaze were remarkable. She had the dead, blank eyes of a shark.
You took off Elspeth Fancourt's style to perfection, for instance.
Fancourt's mouth fell quietly open. For a few seconds, the only sound other than the whispering snow was the barely audible whistle emanating from Elizabeth Tassel's lungs.
I thought from the start that Quine must have had some hold on you, said Strike. You never seemed like the kind of woman who'd let herself be turned into a private bank and skivvy, who'd choose to keep Quine and let Fancourt go. All that bull about freedom of expression. You wrote the parody of Elspeth Fancourt's book that made her kill herself. All these years, there's only been your word for it that Owen showed you the piece he'd written. It was the other way round. There was silence, except for the rustle of snow on snow, and that faint, eerie sound emanating from Elizabeth Tassel's chest. Fancourt was looking from the agent to the detective, open-mouthed. The police suspected that Quine was blackmailing you, Strike said. But you fobbed them off with a touching story about lending him money for Orlando. You've been paying Owen off for more than a quarter of a century, haven't you? He was trying to goad her into speech, but she said nothing, continuing to stare at him out of the dark, empty eyes, like holes in her plain, pale face. "How did you describe yourself to me when we had lunch?" Strike asked her. "The very definition of a blameless spinster. Found an outlet for your frustrations, though, didn't you, Elizabeth?" The mad, blank eyes swiveled suddenly towards Fancourt, who had shifted where he stood. Did it feel good, raping and killing your way through everyone you knew, Elizabeth? One big explosion of malice and obscenity, revenging yourself on everyone, painting yourself as the unacclaimed genius, taking sideswipes at everyone with a more successful love life, a more satisfying... A soft voice spoke in the darkness, and for a second, Strike did not know where it was coming from. It was strange, unfamiliar, high-pitched, and sickly. The voice a madwoman might imagine to express innocence, kindliness.
"No, Mr. Strike,"
she whispered, like a mother telling a sleepy child not to sit up, not to struggle.
"You... poor, silly man. You poor thing."
She forced a laugh that left her chest heaving, her lungs whistling.
"He was badly hurt in Afghanistan," she said to Fancourt, in that eerie, crooning voice. "I think he's shell-shocked, brain-damaged, just like little Orlando. He needs help, poor Mr. Strike."
Her lungs whistled as she breathed faster.
"You should have bought a mask, Elizabeth, shouldn't you?" Strike asked.
He thought he saw the eyes darken and enlarge, her pupils dilating with the adrenaline coursing through her. The large, mannish hands had curled into claws.
"Thought you had it all worked out, didn't you? Ropes, disguise, protective clothing to protect yourself against the acid. But you didn't realize you get tissue damage just from inhaling the fumes."
The cold air was exacerbating her breathlessness. In her panic, she sounded sexually excited.
"I think," said Strike, with calculated cruelty, "it's driven you literally mad, Elizabeth, hasn't it? Better hope the jury buys that anyway, eh? What a waste of a life. Your business down the toilet, no man, no children. Tell me, was there ever an abortive coupling between the two of you?" asked Strike bluntly, watching their profiles. "This limp dick business. Sounds to me like Quine might have fictionalized it in the real Bombix Mori."
With their backs to the light, he could not see their expressions, but their body language had given him his answer. The instantaneous swing away from each other to face him had expressed the ghost of a united front.
"When was this?" Strike asked, watching the dark outline that was Elizabeth. "After Elspeth died? But then you moved on to Fenella Waldegrave, eh, Michael? No trouble keeping it up there, I take it,
Elizabeth emitted a small gasp. It was as though he had hit her.
"For Christ's sake!" growled Fancourt.
He was angry with Strike now. Strike ignored the implicit reproach. He was still working on Elizabeth, goading her, while her whistling lungs struggled for oxygen in the falling snow.
"Must have really pissed you off when Quine got carried away, and started shouting about the contents of the real Bombix Murray in the River Cafe, did it, Elizabeth? After you'd warned him not to breathe a word about the contents."
"Insane. You're insane," she whispered,
with a forced smile beneath the shark eyes, her big yellow teeth glinting.
"The war didn't just cripple you."
"Nice," said Strike appreciatively. "There's the bullying bitch everyone's told me you are."
"You hobble around London trying to get in the papers," she panted. "You're just like poor Owen, just like him. How he loved the papers, didn't he, Michael?"
She turned to appeal to Fancourt.
"Didn't Owen adore publicity? Running off like a little boy, playing hide-and-seek."
"You encouraged Quine to go and hide in Talgarth Road," said Strike. "That was all your idea."
"I won't listen to any more," she whispered,
and her lungs were whistling as she gasped the winter air and raised her voice.
"I'm not listening, Mr. Strike. I'm not listening. Nobody's listening to you, you poor, silly man."
"You told me Quine was a glutton for praise," said Strike, raising his voice over the high-pitched chant with which he was trying to drown out his words. "I think he told you his whole prospective plot for Bombix Murray months ago, and I think Michael here was in there in some form. Nothing as crude as vainglorious, but mocked for not getting it up, perhaps. Payback time for both of you, eh?" And as he had expected, she gave a little gasp at that and stopped her frantic chanting. "You told Quine that Bombix Murray sounded brilliant, that it would be the best thing he'd ever done, that it was going to be a massive success, but that he ought to keep the contents very, very quiet in case of legal action, and to make a bigger splash when it was unveiled. And all the time, you were writing your own version. You had plenty of time on your hands to get it right, didn't you, Elizabeth? 26 years of empty evenings. You could have written plenty of books by now, with your first from Oxford. But what would you write about? You haven't exactly lived a full life, have you?" Naked rage flickered across her face. Her fingers flexed, but she controlled herself. Strike wanted her to crack, wanted her to give in, but the shark's eyes seemed to be waiting for him to show weakness, for an opening. "You crafted a novel out of a murder plan. The removal of the guts and the covering of the corpse in acid weren't symbolic. They were designed to screw forensics. But everyone bought it as literature. And you got that stupid, egotistical bastard to collude in planning his own death. You told him you had a great idea for maximizing his publicity and his profits. The pair of you would stage a very public row. You saying the book was too contentious to put out there, and he'd disappear. You'd circulate rumors about the book's contents, and finally, when Quine allowed himself to be found, you'd secure him a big, fat deal." She was shaking her head, her lungs audibly laboring, but her dead eyes did not leave his face. "He delivered the book. You delayed a few days until bonfire night, to make sure you had lots of nice diversionary noise. Then you sent out copies of the fake Bombix to Fisher, the better to get the book talked about, to Waldegrave, and to Michael here. You faked your public row,
Then you followed Quine to Telgarth Road.
No!
Said Fancourt, apparently unable to help himself.
Yes,
said Strike, pitiless. Quine didn't realize he had anything to fear from Elizabeth. Not from his co-conspirator in the comeback of the century. I think he'd almost forgotten by then that what he'd been doing to you for years was blackmail, hadn't he? He asked Tassel. He'd just developed the habit of asking you for money and being given it. I doubt you ever even talked about the parody anymore, the thing that ruined your life. And you know what I think happened once he let you in, Elizabeth? Against his will, Strike remembered the scene. The great vaulted window, the body centred there, as though for a grisly still life.
I think you got that poor, naive, narcissistic sod to pose for a publicity photograph. Was he kneeling down? Did the hero in the real book plead or pray? Or did he get tied up like your Bombix? He'd have liked that, wouldn't he, Quine, posing in ropes? It would have made it nice and easy to move behind him and smash his head in with the metal doorstop, wouldn't it? Under cover of the neighbourhood fireworks, you knocked Quine out, tied him up, sliced him open and... Fancourt let out a strangled moan of horror, but Tassel spoke again, crooning at him in a travesty of consolation.
You ought to see someone, Mr. Strike. Poor Mr. Strike.
And to his surprise, she reached out to lay one of her big hands on his snow-covered shoulder. Remembering what those hands had done, Strike stepped back instinctively, and her arm fell heavily back to her side, hanging there, the fingers clenching reflexively.
You filled a hold-all with Owen's guts and the real manuscript, said the detective.
She had moved so close that he could again smell the combination of perfume and stale cigarettes.
Then you put on Quine's own cloak and hat and left. Off you went to feed a fourth copy of the fake Bombix Mori through Catherine Kent's letterbox. To maximize suspects, and incriminate another woman who was getting what you never got. Sex. Companionship. At least one friend.
She feigned laughter again, but this time the sound was manic. Her fingers were still flexing and unflexing.
You and Owen would have got on so well, she whispered. Wouldn't he, Michael? Wouldn't he have got on marvellously with Owen? Sick fantasists. People will laugh at you, Mr. Strike.
She was panting harder than ever, those dead, blank eyes staring out of her fixed white face.
A poor cripple trying to recreate the sensation of success, chasing your famous father.
Have you got proof of any of this?
Fancourt demanded, in the swirling snow, his voice harsh with the desire not to believe. This was no ink-and-paper tragedy, no grease-paint death scene. Here beside him stood the living friend of his student years, and whatever life had subsequently done to them, the idea that the big, ungainly, besotted girl whom he had known at Oxford could have turned into a woman capable of grotesque murder was almost unbearable.
"Yeah, I've got proof," said Strike quietly. "I've got a second electric typewriter, the exact model of Quine's, wrapped up in a black burqa and hydrochloric-stained overalls and weighted with stones. An amateur diver I happen to know pulled it out of the sea just a few days ago. It was lying beneath some notorious cliffs at Gwythian, Hell's Mouth." A place featured on Dorcas Pengelly's book cover. I expect she showed it to you when you visited, didn't she, Elizabeth? Did you walk back there alone with your mobile,
telling her you needed to find better reception. She let out a ghastly low moan, like the sound of a man who has been punched in the stomach. For a second, nobody moved, then Tassel turned clumsily and began running and stumbling away from them, back towards the club. A bright yellow rectangle of light shivered, then disappeared as the door opened and closed.
"But," said Fancourt, taking a few steps and looking back at Strike a little wildly, "you can't! You've got to stop her!"
"Couldn't catch her if I wanted to," said Strike, throwing the butt of his cigarette down into the snow. "Dodgy knee."
"She could do anything!"
"Off to kill herself, probably," agreed Strike, pulling out his mobile. The writer stared at him.
"You! You cold-blooded bastard!"
"You're not the first to say it," said Strike, pressing keys on his phone.
"Ready?" he said into it. "We're off."
Chapter 49. Dangers, like stars, in dark attempts best shine. Thomas Dekker, the noble Spanish soldier. Out past the smokers at the front of the club, the large woman came, blindly slipping a little in the snow. She began to run up the dark street, her fur-collared coat flapping behind her. A taxi, its for-hire light on, slid out of a side road, and she hailed it, flapping her arms madly. The cab slid to a halt, its headlamps making two cones of light, whose trajectory was cut by the thickly falling snow.
"Fulham Palace Road,"
said the harsh, deep voice, breaking with sobs. They pulled slowly away from the curb. The cab was old, the glass partition scratched, and a little stained by years of its owner's smoking. Elizabeth Tassel was visible in the rear-view mirror as the streetlight slid over her, sobbing silently into her large hands, shaking all over. The driver did not ask what was the matter, but looked beyond the fare to the street behind, where the shrinking figures of two men could be seen, hurrying across the snowy road to a red sports car in the distance. The taxi turned left at the end of the road, and still Elizabeth Tassel cried into her hands. The driver's thick woolen hat was itchy, grateful though she had been for it during the long hours of waiting. On up the King's Road the taxi sped, over thick powdery snow that resisted tyres' attempts to squash it to slush, the blizzard swirling remorselessly, rendering the roads increasingly lethal.
"You're going the wrong way."
"There's a diversion," lied Robin, "because of the snow."
She met Elizabeth's eyes briefly in the mirror. The agent looked over her shoulder. The red Alfa Romeo was too far behind to see. She stared wildly around at the passing buildings. Robin could hear the eerie whistling from her chest.
"We're going in the opposite direction."
"I'm going to turn in a minute," said Robin.
She did not see Elizabeth Tassel try the door, but heard it. They were all locked.
"You can let me out here," she said loudly. "Let me out, I say."
"You won't get another cab in this weather," said Robin.
They had counted on Tassel being too distraught to notice where they were going for a little while longer. The cab was barely at Sloane Square. There was over a mile to go to New Scotland Yard. Robin's eyes flickered again to her rear-view mirror. The Alfa Romeo was a tiny red dot in the distance. Elizabeth had undone her seatbelt.
"Stop this cab!" she shouted. "Stop it and let me out!"
"I can't stop here," said Robin, much more calmly than she felt, because the agent had left her seat and her large hands were scrabbling at the partition. "I'm going to have to ask you to sit down, madam."
The screen slid open. Elizabeth's hand seized Robin's hat and a handful of hair, her head almost side by side with Robin's, her expression venomous.
Robin's hair fell into her eyes in sweaty strands. "Get off me!"
"Who are you?"
screeched Tassel, shaking Robin's head with a fistful of hair in her hand.